We went to the airport that day. I had a shipment home for my horse. We went to the airport, and of course, I wasn't a wreck, but I wasn't even really talking. I was just done, you know. And we were sat at the bar in the airport waiting for a plane. And I looked at him and I said, what do I do now? Like, you know, you waited your whole life for that moment, and you've got this one great horse, and that's your time.
There is a depth and a breadth to our lives that largely goes unexplored. As an equestrian life mindset coach and host of this podcast, I am here to lead you on that exploration. Deep conversations covering topics in and out of the show ring with industry leaders and unsung heroes alike, sharing their stories and what makes their journey unique, but relatable at the same time. We all have stories to share and lessons to trade, something we've learned from a horse or from each other. So relax and be ready to listen with more than just your ears. I'm Tracy Mitchell. Welcome to Hitting Your Stride. Welcome back to the Hitting Your Stride podcast. I'm your host, Tracy Mitchell, and today's guest is someone I think you'll find nothing short of amazing. Joining the show today is Leslie Grant Law, a woman who has been at the top of Canada's eventing scene for years. Having grown up outside of Toronto, Leslie now resides with her husband, also named Leslie, in Ocala, Florida, where they own and operate Law Eventing. Leslie's riding chops are what you would call bona fide. She's been short or long listed for the Canadian team 8 times, a reserve Pan Am rider 2x, and would have represented the red and white in Beijing in 2008 had it not been for an untimely injury to her horse, Timber Spirit, just before those games. Over the years, Leslie has had multiple placings at all levels of FEI eventing, including a top 20 at Rolex. While her passion for riding has consumed her life, Leslie made sure she had her bases covered by earning a double major honors degree in philosophy and political science from York University, and followed that up by getting her master's in political science, specializing in human rights, and graduating magna cum laude. Leslie credits riders Gary Roque, Peter Gray, and Hugh Graham among her earlier influences, and Christelotte Boylan for the more recent impact on her riding. But as she puts it, no one compares to what my husband Leslie, a British event rider and gold medalist, has suffered through in his timeless help with my riding. The couple have a 12-year-old son, Liam. Leslie, I am thrilled to have you join Hitting Your Stride today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here.
Yeah, this is great. You're a busy woman, I am sure. So this is much appreciated.
No problem.
All right. So when I was doing my prep work for this podcast, you said 2 things that really stuck with me. You compared yourself to a salmon and say you've always been good at swimming upstream, but you haven't achieved many of your younger self dreams. Has being determined to get what you want kept you from going after what you really want? Or has your younger self realized that her goals have changed?
That is a really good question. And this is not the usual podcast where you're supposed to ask me what my favorite horse is. That's very intense. But I think to answer your question, my younger self, you know, didn't have, when you're in relation to my present self, younger self goals, my younger self, didn't have goals as so much as when you're a kid, you have dreams, don't you? And there's definitely a difference between dreams, you know, pretty much produced by Disney that you have as a kid, and then what your goals as an adult are. And why I've always compared myself to the salmon, or sometimes I compare myself to a cockroach, 2 things which have some redeeming qualities, although not very attractive, is that I was never to be a rider. You know, some people grow up with the help or support or the family to be a rider. And that was not in my grand design. You know, growing up just outside of Toronto, I had super parents, and they instilled in me extremely good traits, you know, everything they did to the best of their ability and well, and nothing was half done. And so they created that in me and created, they taught me how to work, that's for sure as well. But they were also, you know, I was the youngest by a lot. And so my parents were older when they had me, and they were just of that generation that what a good parent did, if they wanted their daughter to be successful, there was definitely some preconceived notions of the career paths that a successful daughter would have. Certainly a doctor would have been great, a lawyer. Then I got a bit older and they saw that I was obsessed with animals, so a vet became acceptable as well. And my poor dad even used to do things like, for presents, he'd give me little mementos from, you know, to try and spur me on my career path. Like I had some propaganda from Osgoode Law School one year, or or the best was he had a, you can get artists, you know, to personalize their art. And he gave me, I think I was like 13, and I got this painting of a beautiful woman in a lab coat with animals all around her. And the plaque behind her said, Dr. Grant, you know? So there was definitely the places I was supposed to go, and riding horses was just not where two successful city people perceived their daughter being successful. That wasn't a successful, you know, career path. So that was A. And then when I finally wore them down, I went from, you know, riding school lessons once a week, and I wore them down at 16. And the horse I finally got was a rising four-year-old off the track thoroughbred mare, and you know, you're not destined for success with that at the age of 16. And I was at a barn, and every other 16-year-old there were hunter jumper riders, and they had, you know, beautiful hunter jumper ponies that all, you know, jump like this. And of course I had my three or four-year-old thoroughbred mare. And of course, you're 16, you want to do the same things. And so every day, and I mean, just about every day, I would fall off that thing. And she, the poor thing, would go running back to the barn. And it was a concrete jungle outside Toronto. And she would like splat, hit the asphalt going to the barn and skid on her side. And I would wander back there. And back then, all we had was Blue Coat. Remember that spray?
Yes.
For cut?
Yeah.
And so that poor mare, you know, spent her life being blue, because I'd clean her up, I'd spray her off, I'd look at my arm, probably spray a bit on myself. And that mare lived blue because she was forever hitting the pavement, and luckily never getting hurt. But I mean, so that's where it started. And actually, just to where it ended with that poor mare was 2 years later, we finally got to prelim. And I think in my second or third prelim, the poor thing died on top of me cross country, because lo and behold, she had a heart murmur, which of course we never knew, because a vet check, what was a vet check? You know, there was no vet check when we bought this horse. So it's like, yeah, all the way along, I was never, ever, ever supposed to ride horses, or neither was it ever easy or anything like that. And then when you hit adulthood, you know, and you want to talk about those dreams, well, when you're doing those dreams as a kid, the how and the why never comes, you know, the how and where never comes into your dreams as a kid. You know, I was going to the Olympics. I would be there at least three times. I would have a string of advanced horses and probably two or three Grand Prix horses. And then you turn into an adult and you're like, well, how? And, you know, in Toronto, I'd have a better chance learning how to play the xylophone than ride a horse, let alone get good at it. And so then that comes along and you're trying to make a living and support yourself. And then at that point, you know, so that's where then the goals come in, and you have to say, you know, what's a realistic goal for me that doesn't require me to hang around the house and wait for, who is it, Ed McMahon or whatever, to come to your doorbell with the big check?
Yeah,
right? Because that's what it would need for me to get those dreams. So then you say, okay, my goals have to be what I can do without waiting for a miracle. And what I determined then was, the one thing I could do was educate the hell out of myself, because I was good at that. I was a great student, and I could educate the hell out of myself, and I could look and learn, and I could become as educated a rider as I could possibly be. I could do that without a lot of money. And I could just try to figure out goals within my goalposts, where my goalposts stood. And then at the same time, wrapped my brain on how to broaden those goalposts, you know, that maybe there'd be a way I could broaden them and I could have other stuff too. But in the meantime, what could I do within reality? And so I think in a long, convoluted way of answering your question, you know, when you're younger, you've got the big dreams, then you get older and some people can do those dreams. And a lot of us have to then work on goals, which are based in reality. And that's what I've tried to do since.
I really like that answer, you know, because you see, oh, you know, follow your dreams. But I think you're the first person I've ever talked to that's actually said as kids, you know, it's realistic. It's not realistic. You hear kids talking about their dreams, but you're right. As we turn to adults, they turn into goals. So are you able to get them done? If yes, then how are you going to do that? If no, broaden your goalposts, see what else you can do. I think that's awesome. Yeah. And you're very gritty. I love that. Very gritty, very good salmon-like qualities, swimming upstream and making things happen. That's amazing. So staying with that determined mindset, tell me about how you feel when you think about being always almost there. So you've been shortlisted, as mentioned, for the Canadian team 8 times, reserve Pan Am team twice, and just missed going on to Beijing. How any one of those things might be enough to break a lesser person's will to keep trying. So how deep does your well of determination go?
Well, yeah, I'm a fantastic bridesmaid. I have a dress in every color of lilac and teal and everything. I am a very good bridesmaid. The 2 times for the Pan Ams, the first time was a bit of a cluster. I mean, that got kind of political. And I think it hurt a little bit because I felt like it was a political move. And actually, a lot of stuff got shaken up in Canada after that. So that one hurt a little bit. The second one, Pan Am one, wasn't so bad because although I had done very well with the mayor, that was the most recent time. And she'd won a lot and she'd done, I think we were 4th in the last 3-star right before the Pan Ams. And I understood it though, because she was very young. She was super young. She was like 8 years old. And so we had had great success and she's a fantastic horse, but I was okay with that one because I always put myself in the selector's shoes and the coach's shoes. And I thought, you know, she is kind of a risk because of her age. So I didn't mind that one, but the 2008 Beijing, that was a soul cruncher. That was the hard one because, and I'll tell you the quick story that I don't think ever told anyone this before, but or part of it at least, in 2008. So again, I was a reserve. I was a listed reserve along with a few others. It was in the summer and I was up, Leslie and I had our farm in Virginia in the summers back then. And David wanted everyone down for a training camp in Ocala. David O'Connor was the coach at the time. And he wanted everyone down to Ocala, to Mrs. Mars's farm for a training camp. And as we're getting ready to go down there, very sadly, one of the other ladies that was on the team, her horse got injured. And so we knew, those of us coming down as the backups, you know, we knew one of us was going to end up going in her place. And David had already preconceived, he had planned a mock event that he wanted us to do, and he designed a full mock event for us. And so A, in preparation, and B, I guess that was our time to battle it out for who wanted that open spot, really. So I came down alone with my horse. A friend of mine picked up my horse and I came down, and our barn was going to Maui Jim Horse Trials in Chicago. So Leslie and the rest of my barn were headed to Chicago. And I went down on my own. And I did this mock event and my horse was fantastic. He was unreal. The two jumping phases, he was very good. We were great. And I knew that night, it was run over 2 days. And I knew that night, I knew, you know, we had a little cocktail party thing and I knew that it was mine, you know, it was mine. And that night, this is so pathetic, but it's good for people to hear. That night, I was staying at a friend's place because I didn't own a place here yet. And friends of ours had been kind enough to give me their home that was empty at the moment, you know, in the summer for free for me to stay while I was down here. And that night I went to bed in their house and they had this big mirror on the wall, you know, in their bedroom. And I sat on my bed and I practiced telling my mother and my husband the next morning, because it was going to go public the next morning. I practiced what I was finally going to tell my mom, you know, and my husband. You look like you're about to cry. Don't cry. Anyway, I was like, this is it. I've finally done it. I'm going to get to tell my mom that it wasn't all in vain. And my poor husband that's done so much for me is going to get to live this with me. And this is like the best thing ever. And then I woke up the next morning and I got my coffee at Dunkin' and I went to the barn where everyone was. And David's like, right, we're going to jog up for the vet, who, and the vet was a friend of mine. She'd be my vet forever. And I groomed my horse and he looked great. And I took him out and I jogged him up and he limped the whole way. He limped the whole way down the jog strip. And my mouth just fell open because I jogged him the night before. Everything was great. He looked great. His legs were so tight and he limped. And they rushed me off to the, you know, wash rack and the vet got out all her equipment. And David was there and we're all standing there and she's got the ultrasound down just above his hoof. And she, the vet, my friend, starts crying and I'm holding the horse. Aww. And I'm like, this is not good. This is not good. And David said, you know, is there anything we can do? And she's like, no. And it was a little collateral that she could just see the top of out of his hoof. And, that was that. And so I gave my horse a hug and I looked at David and I said, is it okay if I go off for a moment? And he said, yeah, yeah, you know, of course. And he said to me, I'm so sorry, you know, that place was yours. And I got in my little car and I drove to the closest grocery store and I went to the back of the parking lot and I just lost it. And then I had to call my husband and tell him, instead of telling him that I made it, I had to tell him that the horse was broken. That was it. But the good news was, and if there's anything to be known about my husband, it's this. He had just finished, you know, that day, the event in Chicago. And he drove our humongous 6-horse trailer straight to O'Hare. And he got out and one of our great girls got in the driver's seat and he went straight into the airport and got on a plane. And he came down and got me. But the silver lining, because you always have to find the silver lining, that's right, is that we went to the airport that day. I had a shipment home for my horse. We went to the airport and of course I wasn't a wreck, but I wasn't even really talking. I was just done, you know, and we were sat at the bar in the airport waiting for a plane. And I looked at him and I said, what do I do now? Like, you know, you waited your whole life for that moment and you've got this one great horse and that's your time. And then what do you do now? And I think I had two, you know, young horses at the time. And he looked at me and of course he's the perfect man, right? So he doesn't know what the hell to say to me because he doesn't do girl emotions, right? But he feels bad. He's just gotten on a plane from Chicago. And he looks at me and he goes, well, we'll do whatever you want. And I said, well, if we're ever going to have a baby, we better do it now. And so he said, well, if that's what you want, that's what we'll do. And so it was a few months after that, that our son was conceived. And, you know, I didn't, at the time, it looked like a booby prize, I guess, but looking back at it now, it was the best thing that ever happened to either of our lives. So I try to look at that story as one of the most horrific, sad stories of my life, but also the best story of my life, because who knows if that would have ever happened. If I had gone to Beijing and done pretty good, you know, I might have just kept going, and I might have said, I don't have time for a kid. And so maybe, well, for sure, it all happened for a reason. And we've got Liam now, which is perfection.
Aw, Leslie, thank you so much for sharing that. That story, wow, is amazing. And it's just so real, right? Like in the moment where you're just like, you're telling of it, you know, with your sense of humor, et cetera, you know, telling it what it is, but in that moment, my goodness. But yes, you're right. We've all got to be able to see the silver lining at some point in time, because everything works out just as it should. I know that sounds pretty cliche and it's an old saying, but it's one that's gotten me through a lot of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So with like taking that grit, like you say, you're very good at being a bridesmaid. Do you feel like that's almost your superpower? Like, can you turn that around for yourself and say that, you know, this ability to look at these things and having gone through all of these ups and downs, it gives you a little extra strength that I'm not sure a lot of people could call upon. What do you think?
I'm not sure. I mean, I don't like it.
Yeah.
Sometimes, but you know, I think and I do, I struggle with it. It's a big struggle, but I think, like, I listened to the podcast you did with Crystal a lot, and she said, you know, you just have to put one foot in front of the other. And again, that's cliche and that's simplistic, but it's also 100% accurate. And the thing is, you either keep going or you quit. And I'm not a good quitter. I don't even quit things I should quit. So, you know, you know, you, that's what it is. And, you know, trust me when I say I've spent probably hundreds of nights on my porch looking at the stars at these times and thinking, there's got to be something else out there that would be easier that I would like to do. And I'm smart and I can learn and, you know, I could do anything. What would I like to do? And then I'm like, this is me and this is my passion and this is my life and this is what I share with my husband. And I don't like it a lot of the time, but I love it a lot of the time as well. And I think that's what it is. I don't think it gives me a superhuman anything. I think it just, that's your only choice. You know, riding is not for sissies. Horses are not for sissies. Even the ones that have it a lot easier than I do, that are a lot more privileged than I've had, they, you know, horses take everybody at some point. They don't, you know, they're not discriminatory. They'll crush everybody's dreams and hopes at some point, because that's the nature of the game. And that's what also makes it so special, the good times, and makes you so appreciative of it. So, you know, the option is to quit or keep going, and you got to hold on to the great times and remember them. And you got to realize in the bad times that you're not alone, and it just sucks when it's happening to you, but it happens to everybody.
Yeah. I mean, that is definitely something to think of. You're not alone in these moments when you're faced with that extreme sadness and overwhelm. And yeah, because that's the world of horses. And you're right. It's because we love them that we continue to do what we do. Yeah. So you did mention Crystalot. And when I recently interviewed her, she talked about how Ian Miller would learn and absorb things just by watching. Stealing with his eyes, she said that he called it. You talked about learning from your surroundings as well, having quality people around you who have the smarts and experience that they're willing to share. How do you identify those types of people, and what is most important when it comes to learning something new?
Well, I think, you know, stealing with your eyes is genius. I mean, that is such a great saying, and I'm totally going to steal it now. but it's true. And there's kind of two subjects in that question. The stealing with your eyes thing is, you know, in this day and age, we're so lucky. You know, when I'm not that old, but even when I was a teenager and 20, you know, we didn't have the internet, did we? We didn't have YouTube and that kind of thing. And so then I used to go every time I could, whatever, dressage, show jumping at Palgrave, right? Because that was close to my home. I'd go and just hang out at the Ingate and just watch, right? Now, you know, Leslie and I, we're all so lucky. I can do that from my couch. You know, I don't have to go anywhere. And literally, you know, Leslie and I are both passionate scholars of horses and of riding. And honest to God, like 5 days a week, we'll probably watch something, you know, a dressage show, a show jump show. It's so easy to find top competitions from Europe or North America, and we'll just watch whatever. And I love it because I look at them, and whether it's Carl Hester or Ian Miller, and I'm like, I feel like I'm watching a magician saw a woman in half, and I'm like, how is he doing that? And you know, I'll watch Carl's hands, and then I'll rewind it, and then I'll watch his legs, and then, you know, I'll watch the show jumpers and what lines they took and how are they doing it. And you know, so quite honestly, there's no excuse to not watch these days. Now that we have the internet, you can just watch and watch and watch, and for free. It's amazing. And then on top of that, you know, we always try and put, or I've always tried to put very good people around me, because that's the other thing. If you're lucky enough to find a few people older, wiser than yourself, and you're willing to listen to them, whether you like what they say or not, that's the other key. You can be very lucky and get a lot of free help. You know, Crystalot's very good to me. If I can chat to her, I can send her a video. She'll be up there in a snowstorm. She'll let me know what she thinks. Barbara Mitchell is another like great Canadian jewel that somehow I've battered her into watching videos of me, and she's kind, and she'll give me pointers and say, you know, you shouldn't do this, you should try that. And I listen to that, and I can't necessarily do everything that people tell me. I can't necessarily absorb everything or whatever, but if I can absorb a piece of it, a tiny, tiny piece of it, then I'm so much farther ahead than I was yesterday. And, you know, I put, you know, my husband, we've been married for forever, but I still watch him because he's a genius, and I can never stop watching him. And there's a lot of ways him and I are different, and I can't ride like him. He's way stronger than me and way, you know, but I'm still always learning, you know, his response to the horses. And if this happens, what does he do? And, you know, he helps me a couple times a week, which is great. But, you know, every time I'm riding, I've got half an eyeball on him as well to see what he's doing, because he's genius. And, you know, I think that's the responsibility that someone takes upon themselves. If you want to get better, that's what you're doing. A, watch, like steal with your eyes, like Ian says, and B, surround yourself with the right people. Mm-hmm. Don't surround yourself with the wrong people. That's for sure. So surround yourself with those you wish to emulate or try to emulate.
Yeah. And I think we're really lucky. I mean, having done this podcast for over a year now, almost a year and a half, it's been quite obvious to me that a real pattern is developing, that the really genius people, the ones that we would consider the great ones or the really good ones, they're also willing to pay it forward. They're also willing to advise and to, you know, to help or mentor in some way. And I'm just so grateful for, you know, the bits I've received from them doing this. It's been quite awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So one of the articles I read about you talked about how you and your husband, Leslie, are able to work together and be so successful. You say that 95% of the time it's a pleasure to work with him. But tell me about that 5% and how you learn from it and put that experience to good use.
Well, I think the 5%, you know, 95% of the time, like I said, we help each other very well. Obviously, he's streets ahead of me in every way. I also say he's 11 years older than me, but you know, but I'll never, you know, he was going around badminton on a stallion at 19. I mean, I was in Toronto at 19 trying to graduate. So, I mean, I'll never catch up to what he knows is huge. And the experiences he's had is huge. But he's a great help to me. And I've grown to be a very good help to him. Like, as far as eyes on the ground, he uses me all the time for his eyes on the ground. And I'm a good help to him that way. And we share a lot of ideas, and that's perfect. And the 5% of the time we have trouble, he'll tell you it's always my fault, but it's probably in the difference, like I mentioned before, whereas we have a very hive mind as far as philosophy of training and horsemanship. And if we taught a lesson and you had a transcript of it, you probably wouldn't be able to tell who was who. You know, we teach a very similar lesson. We believe in the same style and philosophy of riding and training and horsemanship. But the one thing we're quite different at is, and I'm not sure why, I don't know if it's a male, female thing or whatever, but he is a very strong rider. His body, you know, when he's riding, he looks like he has on one of those kids, you know, superhero suits with the muscles everywhere, you know. And when he wears a t-shirt, I'm like, oh my god, there's like muscles everywhere, you know, his core. And his he always is with the horse. It's not that he's strong against the horse, he's always with the horse, but his strength is unreal, whereas I am super soft. Like Chris Lutz told me, I look double jointed on a horse, you know, or like Cirque du Soleil. Like, I'm very soft rider, probably because when I was a kid, I was so terrible and I was so tight and so, you know, bad with my arms and bad, you know. I'm very conscientious of when I improved myself of always being soft and connected and with the horse. So we have a very big difference in that way. And so probably when we have struggles against each other, is I do things a softer way and he would do things more with his strength. Is not the right word, but it is the right word. You know, when I say strength, it sounds like he's being physical. He's not physical. He's a beautiful rider, but he's strong and I'm not strong. You know, my horses, I train them to be polite. I train them to be, whereas he can ride dragons, you know, I cannot ride a dragon. He can ride dragons. And so that's where sometimes I'm like, I can't do that. Like, I don't know if men are actually aware. Why would they, how would they be of how strong? When he rode my horses when I was pregnant and I got back on them cross country, oh my God, I got whiplash because my horses were so used to being, you know, what he says is a little strong would be taking me to Miami tomorrow, you know, it would be very strong, you know. And so that's probably the one difference between us where we would struggle with each other is knowing the our fields are different. Yeah. You know, what's it, you know, it's like you can get in your grandparents' car and touch the brake pad and get shot through, you know, the windshield because their brakes are so funny, right? That's like us, you know, we have a different feel. And that's probably the one thing that we would fight about, I guess, fight about. But then you asked how I reconcile it. Hopefully he'll never, ever listen to this podcast, but I know he is better than me and more experienced than me. So I always tell myself, you know, even though I really don't think he understands my strength or understands women versus men, I know he's right. So I just have to find out how to apply his rightness to what I can do physically. And that just takes a little sorting out sometimes.
Yeah.
But,
that's interesting.
Yeah. That's how I reconcile it, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, that's a good way of looking at it. And, you know, maybe he won't listen to this. That's okay.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. How did the accident you suffered where you broke your leg while you were pregnant affect you mentally? How did you learn to apply new lessons about life in the aftermath of that during your rehab and then eventually getting back in the saddle?
That was tough because, it made me appreciate walking. I mean, I couldn't walk for 6 months. So that's tough. You know, like you hate, I don't think I'm a person that is bad and takes a lot for granted, but I'll tell you what, I sure took that for granted, because when you go from being so active your whole life to being not able to walk, you know, that's really terrible. And then on top of that, being pregnant is awful, because I was always such a physical person. And then it was like, I can't do anything. Oh, and I'm getting fatter by the moment, you know, like it was just, it was a terrible time. But the good news is, like we just talked about being eyes on the ground, I had nothing to do but watch and teach. And so I learned a lot actually during those 6 months by sitting at the ring. I'd sit at the ring, I'd bring an extension cord out, I'd have a game ready on my leg, trying to get swelling out of it all the time. And, or I had a machine that would mechanically move my leg for me. So I'd either have the machine on or I'd have the game ready on icing it. And then I'd sit at the side of the ring literally all day long. So I did still make good use of my time as far as learning and watching and teaching, and you learn so much teaching too. So that was good. And then, you know, but it didn't really affect me that badly mentally, because it was a freak accident the way I broke it. So it's not like I had a fear of it happening again, really. It just, I don't know what else to say other than it made me really appreciate being mobile. And I tried to use my time as best as possible, you know, sat all day long watching. And then finally, about like 3.5 months into it, when I could get around on crutches, you know, I got up one day and I was so fed up and I yelled at Leslie and I said, you're going to have to teach one more lesson a week because I'm going to get a personal trainer, because I just couldn't stand the whole thing. So I drove around and found a gym till I could find, you know, someone that would deal with a very pregnant, broken legged person. And I was like, there's nothing wrong with my arms. Like they can look amazing and I can do this and that still. And then I started working out as much as I could. But, you know, as far as after that, I couldn't wait to ride again. I was happy to ride again and kind of put that behind me, kind of thing.
Good. Yeah. Just getting back in the saddle. You had no hesitation. It's just like, bam, this is where I need to be. Yeah. That's great. So you have also talked about being a passionate scholar and being desperate to make your parents happy, but you eventually realized that you had to live life for yourself and be happy on your own terms. What was the tipping point that showed you that? And have you been able to help others find that for themselves?
The tipping point for that was, you know, I got all that education, all those university degrees, and I was willing, like I always knew I wanted to ride, but I was willing to try something out, you know, just to make my parents. And I did go for a few job interviews. Like I started looking into jobs and working for the government, because I thought, you know, maybe CSIS interested me or United Nations type stuff. So I thought, well, you start here. And then I started putting on like these like skirt suits and going into Toronto and going into these interviews and being shown like where I'd work. And of course, for those jobs, you know, you don't get sent to the United Nations. You know, you start at the bottom, and the bottom is like this little office cubicle in downtown Toronto. And I was like, you know, probably eventually I would grow to like it when I got higher up the ladder, but I'm like, this box is not where I live. You know, I love to be outside. I love to be out in the world, and I don't begrudge it of anybody what anybody does, and there's something for everybody, but a box wasn't for me. And I was like, can't do it. And then I had a really good. You know, I was, got a nice job with Hugh Graham and King Ridge, and they were very, very good to me. And I still evented, and I was able to do both. And, you know, I knew I couldn't live at that level, you know, as far as money wise and stuff forever, but it was a start, and it was way better than being in a box, which was never me. And then as far as how I try to help other people to do it, I mean, the closest people around me as far as kids I try to help are our working students. I was a working student, and I like to give back to other working students, because if I couldn't have been a working student, I wouldn't have gotten to where I've been, because I couldn't pay my way. And so I always try to have some working students, and we always have a couple really good ones. They're like my little sisters all the time. And I try to tell them to be very observant, you know, and look, but also know what it is you're looking at, be able to identify a lot of horse people of which I would admire myself as well, but they are self-sufficient. They're not running a business. They don't have to work. And so that's not that you shouldn't admire them and their riding, but I tell my kids, don't look at them as your life, because that will never probably be your life. And so look at the people like Leslie and I, and there's others out there that are actually working and being successful with a career. And then ask yourself, is that what you'd want? Because there's no good looking at other people that are living differently and saying, yes, that's what I want, but you can never have it. I said, make sure you look at people that are actually working and having careers in it, and then ask yourself, is that what you want? And if it's not what you want, I said, you know, please give me 3 months notice, but run the hell out of here now while you're young and find what it is you do want. And if it is what you want, then you're in a great place to start with us, and we'll look after you. And by all means, grab it with both hands and try your best with it. But don't just look around, know what you're looking around at, kind of thing, and then decide if it's for you.
Yeah, be very discerning, ask questions, you know, research, look into it, and get different points of view, even if they're not what you want to hear.
Exactly.
Yeah. Can you describe the evolution of your riding? Are you happy with where it's at right now, or is there a part of you always striving to improve in some appreciable way?
My riding right now, I am pleased with. How's that? Because like I said to you, I was terrible. I mean, I was really awful when I started riding, but then, you know, I say that and it's factual, but also when I look back at it now as a professional, I'm like, well, how is a 16-year-old coming off of school horses going to learn feel on an off-the-track thoroughbred three-year-old? I mean, so I'm telling you, I was awful and I was awful, but of course I was awful because, you know, how was I going to be anything else at that stage? And, you know, I stayed awful for a really, really long time. And I actually was able, going back to my salmon / cockroach characteristics, I actually got pretty far being awful, because like the cockroach, you know, you throw your shoe at it against the wall and it drops to the floor and still runs away. So I actually got really far up being awful. And then it wasn't till actually like when I started working for Hugh and stuff that like Hugh was like, you're awful, you know, like he was like the first person to be like, hate to tell you what, because he says what at the end of every sentence. He says, hate to, you know, what are you doing? And I was like, oh man, I kind of thought I was good, you know, because I got pretty far being awful. You know, they were even writing stuff about me in magazines, but I was awful. I was just a good cockroach. I just outlived others, right? And so at that point, I was like, you're right, I'm awful, and I don't want to be awful, and I don't want to be embarrassing. And, you know, I want to be someone that somebody walks past the ring and they're like, boy, she's a beautiful rider. And boy, aren't her horses lovely trained. And, you know, that's what I wanted to be. And so I made it a big mission to get skilled. I had no dressage, no show jumping skills whatsoever. I just had determination and stubbornness and grit. Yep. And so I was like, right, I've gone this far, now I have to pretty this pig up, you know. Like, so then I started working really hard, and I am at the point now where I can hold my head with pride with my show jumping, and it's pretty good. It's good. My show jumping's good. My dressage is getting there. Cross country, I've always been, like I said, the cockroach. So I've always gone and gotten around, and I've gotten pretty good technically at it. To be honest, my biggest problem with that at the moment that I'm not sure how to reconcile is with my mind, because, you know, this weekend I was fourth and fifth in the American Intermediate, you know, which is, it's good with two young horses. It's great, but I should have been second and third. I had took some time on them. One was doing its first one, so that's okay. But, you know, 8 seconds would have put me second or third, and second and third. And I don't do it because I've still got this thing in my head where, because I've never had much, I've only ever, you know, had one horse, maybe two, you know, back to Beijing, where it's gone in a heartbeat. And so I always have that thing when it comes down to how much I should push them cross country. I'm like, no, this is fine. You know, I don't want to take that last gamble around that turn in the rain and blow out that leg, you know, and because, you know, that's always in the back of my head. What else do I have? I don't have anything, you know? And but the problem is you can't win that way. To win, you got to block that out. But that is very much in my head because of my past and where I came from. And I'm doing a lot better now and have a lot more now, but still not as much as many and most doing what I'm doing. And so that, it's not wrong, but it's not right. And I'm not quite sure how to reconcile that in my brain yet. I'm still working on it. My husband, you know, tries to tell me, oh, this would be another part of the 5%, you know, where he'll say, Leslie, you're so good. You should just go. And, you know, 5 seconds, you would have won. And I'll say, that's easy to come in from a guy with 9 horses when I've got 3 horses, you know, and your experiences versus my experience. You know, I've just got a little bit of that person, you know, I forget what they call those women that are worried they're going to get old and eat cat food. They got that problem in their head. I've got the problem where I'm like, in a second, I could have nothing again. And so I've got to reconcile that if I want to be, you can count on me. I'm good enough. You can count on me to be third, fourth, fifth. If I want to be, and sometimes first, I'd like to be first more often. And to do that, I'm going to have to reconcile that in my head cross country. And then as far as the rest of the question, yes, I'm pleased, but on the other side of it, I'm not nearly good enough. That's why I watch those videos every day.
Yep.
Because I'm still, I don't suck anymore, but I'm not nearly good enough. And that is the passion of horses though, for all of us, isn't it? Because unlike, you know, when you read that book, if you love reading, I love reading. When you get that great book or that great series on Netflix, I love Yellowstone. I love Money Heist. And you get to that last episode or that last page and you're so sad because you don't want it to end and you love the characters. Well, that is the best part about riding, is that the book never ends. There is never a last episode. There is always another page and there is always another episode. And I have never met, of all the quote unquote heroes in the horse world that I know, I have never met one that says they're happy with their riding. They always have something else to learn.
Wow. That thirst for knowledge is what keeps you going. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Now I just have to ask you, your sense of humor is evident and I love it. Do you find that your sense, like is your sense of humor something that's you've always had and that you just rely on to get you through tough times? And I know you write a lot, and a couple of two or three of the articles that I got information on you, I got from ones that you wrote, and your writing is funny. Like where does your sense of humor come from? And does it help you get through those tougher times?
I don't know. I'm not creative at all. Like I do love writing, and I wish I could like think of Harry Potter and that would be fabulous and write something like that, and then I would have less problems and I'd have so many horses to ride I wouldn't have time to talk to you. But I'm not creative. I couldn't tell a joke or think of a joke to save my life. But I think where my humor comes from is I have, you know, life is very sad sometimes and very tragic, and all you have to do is turn on the news right now and see how awful life can be. But there is also something every day naturally occurring in the world, in your life, that is like, I find absolutely hysterical. Like if you know how to look at it, there's something funny that happens every day, just naturally. And I think that's what I'm good at grabbing hold of and like pointing out to other people, is just finding those moments. Like I just said, we were at the show on the weekend and in the intermediate, and Leslie and I had intermediate horses, and I had one horse that was doing his first intermediate, young horse, and the forecast for the weather was like hell was going to rain down upon us. And sure enough, you know, I went out there on my first horse, my little tiny Romeo horse, to do the intermediate, and it was dark. It was very dark, you know, when the clouds roll in and it's incredibly dark. And I was kind of squinting to see the third fence and kind of saying, I hope to God you can see, little horse, because I can barely see, you know, just that dim, dark storm's coming. And so I went around with him and he was fabulous. And I was thinking to myself, all right, I can call this a day. Like, let's scratch the other two. The young one doesn't have to do his first intermediate in this condition, and I don't need to ride the mare. And I can call it a day with that. But then I was like, get back to the trailer, and the girls have gotten the other horse tacked up, and now it's really dark. Like I'm gonna need like a miner's light, you know. But I'm thinking, this is what I do for a job. I better get my butt on that horse, because it's actually like just spitting and it's just dark and it's not really bad. So I get on the horse and I'm going over to warm up, and I'm looking at all these people, you know, doing what you do in warm up, cantering and jumping the jumps, and I'm looking around and it's getting darker and darker. And I'm thinking, we must be the stupidest group of human beings like ever. I'm like, here I'm like a Valkyrie going off to like, you know, hunt the thunder gods or something. This is the stupidest thing ever. And I get that horse done, and it's now I get off at the trailer, and now all hell's breaking loose, and it's lightning and thundering, and it's very dark, and it's raining, and the show is screaming for everybody to get their horses on the trailer. Meanwhile, my poor young horse is like dying, panting, because he just jumped the biggest jumps he's ever seen in his life, and went, you know, practically an hour he thought out there. And you know, you got to put him, cool him out. And we finally get everything thrown on, and all of us jump into the truck, and the windshield wipers are going, and it's crazy. And I look over at Leslie and I'm like, why haven't you turned the engine on yet? He hasn't started the truck. You know, he's just got the windshield and can't even see out the windshield. And he says, well, maybe we'll wait for, you know, because we have three more horses. Maybe we'll wait 45 minutes and see if it gets better. And I'm looking at my iPhone and the whole screen is red. It's just red, the radar. And I said, I am so sorry, but if you expect me to go out in this, I'm going to require, you know, some blue and red face paint and maybe a sword, you know, on the next course, because if I'm going to do this Braveheart stuff and charge in, we're not going for God and country here, honey. We're riding young horses over cross country fences. Like, and sure enough, you know, then everybody kind of laughed and it lightened the mood, you know, in a time when you're sat in the truck not knowing whether, you know, do you tell the owners you're scratching? Well, luckily, you know, the show ended up calling it until the next day. But, you know, that's my humor, is like the everyday stuff that you can pick up. I'm not creative, but I do try to find something funny in every day. And humor, laughter is a great medicine, isn't it? And it's just good for you, really.
It certainly is. And I can definitely appreciate your sense of humor. I'm kind of like that. I mean, I love laughing at myself. If I don't, if I can't laugh, if you can't laugh at yourself, who can you laugh at? You probably shouldn't laugh at anybody. That's the point. Oh, the 20-year-old Leslie that lives somewhere inside you sounds like she got lots to say and has helped shape you in both good and bad ways. What do you think she would say if she could see you looking through your son's eyes?
Oh, that's a weird one. I mean, that's a hard one. I hope looking through my son's eyes.
Can I give you a bit of a lead on that one?
Yeah.
Because when reading up on you, there was this one article where you overheard your son talking about you. And yes. You were picking teams, and he's like, girls can be tough. My mom is fierce. You know, she doesn't cry and won't take crap from anyone. That kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I hope to God, like, Liam, you know, it's funny. He's at the funny age now, 12, where he's actually a human being now. You know, he's starting to become a person and very smart and very intuitive and huge ears. You'll think he's not listening and he's heard it all, and you know, he'll ask a question meanwhile you thought he was watching TV. You know, he's getting to that age now, and I hope to God that you know he knows I wear more hats than haberdashery. You know, I'm a mom, I'm a wife, I'm a business owner, I'm a coach, I'm a writer, I'm a volunteer. I volunteer on a bunch of committees, and I try to do, you know, everything, and I try to do everything well, but it's probably practically impossible all the time to do everything well. But I have one thing I'm very sensitive about is that I've always been worried because of the nature of our job, and other people's jobs are the same, I'm sure, you know, it's a big time commitment, our job. And I've always been very worried that he would think that our job was more important than him. And then, so from a very young age, like since he was 4, I have hammered him with telling him over and over and over again, like trying to explain to him that everything we do is so he can have a better life. And, you know, I include him all the time. When he was younger, he came to shows with us all the time. Every moment I'm not doing a horse thing, Leslie and I go to every soccer game he plays, everything. And I'm also, you know, I'm an event rider, you know, so like, let's just say that's in your mind as well too. And so again, from like, you know, my most horrific fear is that if anything would ever happen to me, that he'd imagine that the horses were more important. That's been a really hard one for me to reconcile, I guess, in my brain. So since the time he was 4, I've told him, like, should anything happen to me, I'll be in that tallest star and I'll be watching you forever, and you better do your homework, you know, like that kind of thing.
Yeah,
because I've tried to hammer into him since he was tiny, basically, that he was the most important, him and his father, hands down, most important, and that the horses are our lives and our passion and our career, but that they could never compare. And so I'd hope anyone looking through his eyes would see that first, and then see all the other stuff second, like the toughness and the hardworking part and all that. I hope they would see that second through his eyes.
Wow. How did that make you feel when you overheard him say that his mom is fierce? I love
it. It was good. You know, it was good. I'm very proud of how our son has turned out. I think he's a better person than either Leslie or I. And so, you know, when I hear some of the things he says about girls, or when I hear some of the things he says about people, like, just, I've, at 12, I've heard him defend, you know, quote unquote fat people. I've heard him defend quote unquote girly girls. I've heard him defend, you know, gay people. I've heard him, you know, and animals. Don't even get him. He's a real animal lover. So, you know, not only is he a tough soccer player and a really smart kid and gets all these awards and stuff, he is a really good human being.
That's wonderful. All right, Leslie, can you finish this thought for me? The absolute best part about being Leslie Grant Law is?
My family and my extended family. So my husband, my kid, my mom, and then by extended family, our owners, like Leslie and I have owners that we've had for ages. I don't, you know, have the owners I wish I had to take, like, we're talking about my riding, where I'd like to go next. You know, unfortunately, I'm going to need more owners and more of all of that. You know, it's not easy being a Canadian living in the United States. Let me tell you that. Why would it be? Everybody's patriotic, but, you know, but the owners we do have, they have been in our life a very long time. They have all eaten at my table for Christmas. They've eaten at my table, you know, for Thanksgiving, and they've become family. You know, my dad's not around. And so some of the older owner, the men have helped me with stuff like that, you know, taxes or investments or whatever, you know, and the women are great. And they are our extended family, and I'm grateful for them. But that's the best part about being me, is the people around me.
Awesome. All right. So what's the next big thing for Law Eventing?
The next big thing, I guess, horse-wise, the 3 days I'll start now. Okay. So, sorry. So in 2 weeks, the younger horses, the two-star, three-star horses will all do their 3 days. They're doing, you know, their first two stars or their first three stars. After that's Kentucky Land Rover. So Leslie will have his oldest horse there. And then there's a four-star after that, where the young advanced horses will go to that. So as far as, you know, next big thing horse-wise, is it's three-day season.
Okay.
So we'll hopefully get that done well.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I hope that Law Eventing and you and your husband, Leslie, have a great rest of your season ahead. And again, thank you so much for this conversation. I was really looking forward to it because, like I said, like, just sort of chatting with you ahead of time and reading about you. And I think you have a lot to offer for those people that maybe are on the same path you've been on, and just finding advice and some understanding on how to get through it. I think it sounds great.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. So there you have it. I have some great interviews lined up for future episodes, and we'll be covering some pretty interesting topics, as always, with the intent to open and engage the horse world on a wide variety of issues. So until next time, keep your eyes forward and continue to hit your stride. To stay current with Hitting Your Stride, subscribe on my website or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. If you like what you've heard here today, make sure you share and leave a comment to help guide future episodes and widen the audience. And be sure to check out social media to keep up to date with Equestrian Elements Life Coaching.